Is your team not performing well? Is morale low and turnover high? Are you falling further behind the competition? I'm here to help. I'm your host, Shaney, and this is the Leadership Show, where business strategy and culture finally meet, and we make the long-awaited shift from rhetoric to results. I promise I'm not your typical boring leadership consultant, and I will help you get your shift together. Let's do this.
Hello, Leadershifters, and welcome to another episode of the Leadership Show with yours truly, Shaney Magoski. It is my pleasure today to introduce you to our guest, Jeremy Bacon. Jeremy, quick hello before I give your bio.
Hi, everybody.
Jeremy is joining us from the great state of Illinois and the great city of Chicago, and that is where we know each other from. Jeremy and I are former colleagues from Goldman Sachs in the equities division. We worked together, we won't say how many years ago at this point, but I was in domestic institutional equity sales, and Jeremy, as a Japanese speaker and, you know, all around Renaissance man, was in the international equities division, but we all occupied the same space in what was then the Sears Tower. And then Jeremy made a big shift to be a serial entrepreneur. His very first company was called Backstop Solutions, which he founded and ran for about a decade before shifting to some other things. And as I said in sort of the pre-call before this, there's a bit of a Jeremy family tree of entrepreneurship that I will let him walk us through in just a minute. Because not only is Jeremy a former colleague and a friend and a model entrepreneur, but he's also one of the most ambitious athletes that I know, and I don't even understand how you fit in the training into your busy life as, you know, an entrepreneur and a father and a husband and a civil servant and some of the other things that you do. But he is an ultra marathon runner and triathlete. And I just think that is so cool because that requires a real dedication and level of commitment that is unusual, let's just say. So, welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Thank you. It's super nice to be here. I appreciate it, Shaney.
Looking
forward to chatting and hopefully sharing a little crazy with you.
Yep, absolutely. God. So, yeah, Jeremy and I were instant friends when we worked together at Goldman because neither of us really drank the Kool-Aid, right? We liked our jobs. We respected the firm, like Goldman back then, great firm, still a great firm. And we were doing cool things, working with smart clients. But I would say neither of us really defined ourselves by that. And we sort of got the joke that this isn't all that's available to us in life, right? Would you agree with that?
Oh, for sure. 100%. I would echo your sentiment. I mean, I loved working at Goldman. And I often joke with people that I was just hanging out with a couple of old colleagues from Goldman yesterday from the Private Wealth Management Group. We were talking about some of the interesting initiatives that they've got going on over there. And, you know, one of them said, you know, one of these days you're just going to have to come back here and work with us. And I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm employable at this point. So I don't know that would ever work. And as much as I loved it there, I think there are three kinds of people that work at Goldman. There are the kinds like you and me who say, we love it, we appreciate it, we're grateful for the experience, the opportunity and the connections and the drive and the support and everything that comes with that amazing organization, but we don't want to be there forever. It's a stepping stone for us in our careers and as we continue to expand our worldviews. Then there are the people that I'm a Goldmanite and I will always be a Goldmanite and I love Goldman Sachs. And you find those kinds of people in every big company, and they're the lifeblood of the organization. They make it hum. And those are some of my best friends. And to this day are folks that are lifers, not just there, but other places across the planet. And then there are the folks that, you know, damn it, I'm going to be a partner and I'm going to do whatever it takes to be a partner. And that's also okay. And that's actually one of the things that's neat about the sort of Goldman hierarchy and the Goldman model.
Mystique,
yeah. It's an amazing place to be. In fact, it was when I was at Goldman, I got really, really into like personality type testing and sort of human psychology. Mm. I'd sit on the floor all day long and on the phone or in front of clients. And it was really fun to sort of think about the underlying motivations for that sort of drove the people that I worked with and the people that I served. And actually, not that I want to talk about Goldman forever, but it was that sort of foundational, I guess, understanding of an interest in psychology that really has influenced me to this moment in thinking about how I want to build culture and how I want to carry culture and how I want to influence culture in the companies that I've started and had the opportunity to work with.
Yeah. Interesting that you bring that up, because I'm in Arkansas this week working with one of my regular clients. I do leadership training with them every year with different cohorts of leaders. And the last 2 days we have focused on DISC, which is obviously one of many different personality behavioral assessments and all of the elements that benefit from being more aware of what your own type is, be able to appreciate what other people do, what other people are, so that you can communicate and influence them differently. And of course, how you relate to customers and prospects differently. And they nailed me because I said, you know, what type do you think I am? And they were like, hi, D.
Yeah.
And, you're and I was like, and I'm pretty much tied with one other. And they're like, oh yeah, you're also a high I. Yes.
I was gonna say, I would guess, you know, looking at Myers-Briggs, you're an ENTJ, I would assume. And for D and with DISC, I'm sure you're a DI, which is exactly what I am. Right. And so, and always have been. And there's a lot of pros and a lot of cons to everything about us as individuals. And because of our individual styles, to me, it's really essential to understand who you are and who the people you work with really are at the end of the day and how they feel. We just did Imagineer, the company I run today. And we'll get to what we do with this business and things like that in a couple of minutes. But we have a book club, and interestingly enough, the book that the team is reading right now, I think everyone's halfway through the book, is Surrounded by Idiots, which is a book that's based on DISC and DISA and DISC. It's the red, yellow, green, and blue methodology, which is, you know, exactly like the DISC methodology with different color codes. But super interesting and super. It's been really fun to watch my teammates yet again sort of discover this and think about, oh, who in this business is a D? And
someone just recently sent me a picture of that book that they saw in the airport, who had taken one of my DISC trainings and was like, look,
here it is.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get into this, because your career has been so interesting. So I guess, first of all, walk us through, why did you make the shift from Goldman to Backstop? And what did you have to do, not only process-wise, but mindset-wise, to make that leap?
Sure. And I will start maybe by taking a half step back from that. And really, for me, the first shift was deciding to go work at a place like Goldman. So for better and for worse, I've been an entrepreneur since I was a little kid. I mean, I started my very first company when I was 8. And I had companies at 8 and 10 and 15. And all through college, I started a couple of businesses even.
Okay, so what was your 8-year-old company?
I consolidated paper routes. So I went... And that's a whole other sidebar, sort side conversation that we could spend an hour talking about. But basically, I figured out that I could make a lot more money as a paper delivery boy if I purchased rights to deliver large chunks of the neighboring paper routes in my area. And so I approached other newspaper delivery boys and girls and said, "Hey, I'll give you X dollars for Y percentage of your route, and I'll do the collections, but I get all the tips and this, that, and the other." And so it ended up being a really good little business for me. And
look at you rolling up newspaper routes, like a born venture cap, or, you know, a born private equity guy, like wringing out the synergies.
The reason I had to do it was because the Denver Post wouldn't let me get more than one route as a kid, or heck, as anybody at the time. I don't think you buy more than one route. And like, well, all right, then I'll just go get them from everybody else. So anyway, I've always been an entrepreneur, for better and for worse, and always knew that I wanted to build businesses. And as I got through undergrad and grad school, I had become very fascinated with the financial markets and with financial services and financial services technology. And I knew that coming out of school, I didn't want to go straight into trying to start a business of my own, because I had never done something at scale, right? I'd never built a business that did millions and millions of dollars in revenue. And I wanted to sort of go to a place where I could figure out how to maybe do that. And that was, you know, at the end of the day, when I was interviewing with Goldman, the 748,000 interviews that we all go through to get in
exactly.
there, and the 16 different divisions in the firm, I ended up having a choice between equity research and institutional equity sales. And I chose sales because it gave me, as you recall, direct access to lots of management teams and lots of analysts. And so versus if I went and became an analyst, I would have had access to teams, but it would have been in a specific sector or category, whatever it might be.
Right. So you decided to go broad rather than narrow and deep.
I did. And, you know, one of the great parts about that job was that it exposed those of us that did it to management teams of very large companies that were going public for the first time, or that were doing secondary offerings, or that were finding new and exciting ways to tap the capital markets on one hand. But it also got us opportunity to sit face to face with some of the world's smartest men and women who are managing money and making decisions about the value and merits of those business plans and business models.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, famous in my own mind for being the most annoying analyst that the CEOs and CFOs and COOs ever had to deal with on the road, because we'd finish meetings and we'd sit down in the limo going to the next meeting, and I'd be like, okay, I got 47 questions based on what you guys, and I would literally just pepper these guys and girls with questions about how they run their business and how they got where they went and what they thought about sales and how did they scale this and what's going on with that. And it was awesome. And then at the same time, I could sit down inside the asset manager's office and look at what they were doing and how they were growing their business and what was working and what wasn't. And honestly, it was sitting inside of a bunch of hedge fund offices and a bunch of endowment and pension fund offices, where a big part of the business plan and the model for what became Backstop sort of was birthed. This was at a time in the early 2000s when hedge funds were becoming a household name. Citadel was a tiny fund at the time, if you can believe it. Didn't even exist, I think, when I started Backstop, or it was just getting started. And you know, of course, now hedge funds play a massive role in world finance.
And Ken Griffin's like probably the richest man in Illinois, if not the broader swath.
Yeah, yeah. And several of the Citadel Cubs, if you want to think of them that way, that have started since are also now billionaires, right? It's been an amazing thing to see. But there were some obvious problems with the businesses that these folks were running, and there were some obvious ways to get involved to build software solutions that would help to fix some of those problems.
Okay.
On top of that, this was the very beginning of the dot-com bubble had burst, you know, in 99 and early 2000, and this was 2003. And software as a service, or ASP, and on-demand software was just becoming a buzzword and becoming a thing. And I wrote software as a kid and all through college, and so I was dangerous with software, and I really was really excited about this notion of on-demand software technology. Mm-hmm. So we decided, hey, let's build a software company to do on-demand software for this category of the industry. And I was lucky enough to meet with a hedge fund manager who had a desire to build businesses and a desire to write checks to start things up, who backed me and backed the team, and away we went. So that led to an amazing journey and a shift in mindset from going like from Goldman Sachs, where at the time I think we had, I don't know, I think we just cleared 20,000 employees, let's say, when I left. And I don't know how many there are today, 50 or some odd thousand, tons, maybe 60, who knows, huge number. But going from that to like me in a closet, working on a business plan, hacking away the first lines of code, trying to figure out what the heck I was going to do, trying to find a co-founding technologist to help me out. And we were fortunate in that we had the right idea and the right product and the right market time, which are essential ingredients to success in entrepreneurship. And in that first 10 years of that business's existence, we kind of mopped up the market, to be totally blunt about it. We became the dominant player in each of the categories we were in. Because we built great software, we built a great culture, we took care of our customers. And then we got to a point where it was time for me to do something different, because I stopped growing, to be totally honest. And so it was another opportunity for me to sort of shift my focus and shift gears into doing something that I wasn't getting the chance to do as, you know, the CEO and co-founder of a rapidly growing software business. So I got lucky and found a way to go be the president of a once rapidly growing software business that had fallen on harder times and was sort of shrinking, and it was publicly traded but was bought by a private equity fund, and I had never had a chance to work for a PE fund before, to be part of a PE board structure. So fell into this amazing opportunity to go help to do a restructuring play and build some new businesses and help to divest some assets and look at other assets to acquire and whatnot, but part of an even bigger business within the financial services technology markets. And was an exciting first sort of 13 or so years of my entrepreneurial and intrapreneurial journey.
So what did you learn from Goldman and Backstop that you kind of brought with you to that role where you were essentially turning around a situation that really worked?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the biggest things that, one of the biggest takeaways from Goldman outside of this desire to focus on human psychology and in building teams and building culture mm-hmm. is the notion of culture itself and the importance that culture plays in building
yes.
a successful organization. Like it's just, so
I wish everybody that ran companies had that mindset. Cause it drives me crazy
yeah.
that people relegate culture to some junior HR person and it's not elevated to the same level. I mean, that's my tagline is where business strategy and culture meet because they have to meet. Yeah.
Right. Well, I think I'm going to say they're obvious. So they're probably not, but some, I think pretty clear reasons why that's the case, why a lot of executives don't get culture or don't think culture first. And that's because a lot of executives are DIs, right? Going back to DISC. A lot of us, I mean, we're naturally passionate people with a desire to grow, expand, explore, drive hard, move fast, break things, work really fast, work really hard, work tirelessly, go crazy and change the world, right? And we carry a culture with us, but oftentimes, right, to sort of drive culture into a group of people and to make that culture stick, DIs we're terrible at that because we're always thinking about the next mountain to climb, right? Like we're actually thinking about the next mountain to climb before we even got to the top of the mountain we're currently climbing because you can already
right.
see way off. Oh, I'm going to go that one next. And so it's really hard for us to stop and say, great, now how do I ensure that all the great things we learned getting up this mountain become part of the permanent culture and stay here? So they, quite frankly, that's where, again, using this, that's where we need our C's, right? That's where we need our analytically minded attention to detail. I'm not going to act until I know exactly what is right and what's good for me and what's going to work types, because
right.
they can help absorb that culture and then spread it through your S's, right? And I's can be great spreaders too. So, but I think you have to think about this holistically. And so many people that are hard charging entrepreneurs or CEOs or execs, like, they're too worried about next quarter or the next product or the next launch or the next customer meeting to sort of feel it's worth their time to focus on culture, but you got to do it. And
absolutely.
To be totally honest about it, like culture is crazy important to me, but like in all the companies I've ever been a part of, including my day job now at Imagineer, I like to think that my teammates see me live our culture every day. But I'm also not the kind of CEO or exec that like that where every communication starts and ends with our four values here are openness, transparency, integrity, and gratitude. Like I don't say those every single day, but that's what we talk about. That's the culture we live.
That's the difference is it doesn't matter how many times people say it, if they're not living, if their behaviors aren't aligned with the words, the dissonance starts to create cultural toxicity.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So that was, to me, that was a big and powerful thing. And like, I believe that good, like the honest truth is, and whether it's a software business or a consulting firm or, or a widget company, the best product almost never wins. It's great when you can have the best product and still win, but it's culture that carries your message and your brand to your client, right? And then it's the way that it's the culture that you carry as a business and your attitude toward the customer journey that drives success for your business and your customer. And that's
absolutely.
Why it's essential.
Absolutely. Oh,
it's absolutely essential.
I love that. Let me just pause and make sure. Did everybody hear that? It's not necessarily the best product that wins, right?
Yeah. It's almost never.
It's the product that resonates with the right message, with the audience, and with the culture of the brand itself, so that employees who are essentially the brand ambassadors are enrolling customers. Because you know what? The person in charge can't do all that.
Right.
So you've got to, the culture has to cascade so that anyone that a customer prospect is encountering is a brand ambassador, and that is built from the culture. Because if you don't give a shit, you're not going to put your best foot forward in any interaction with a customer or prospect.
Totally right. Yeah. And at the end of the day, products are always improving and products never done ever in any business. It's never done.
Yeah.
That's why focusing on having the absolute perfect product before you go to sell it it's a fool's errand, because you'll never have the perfect product.
Oh, and for sure.
Every customer's needs and wants and desires from your product are different. So you just can't win. You never win with product. You have to win with culture, and you have to win with brand and value.
Let me ask you this. Can we go back to backstop for a second? Because there's something that's lingering for me that I think listeners and watchers will be interested in. So you were introducing a software package at the very early days of SaaS. So let's call it leading / bleeding edge.
Totally bleeding edge, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Part of your sale was actually education, if I may take an educated guess.
That's exactly right. In fact, the first several times I went to sit down with prospective clients and also with other industry participants. So within the world of hedge funds and the markets, you've got these entities called prime brokers that live inside of big investment banks like Goldman Sachs. And prime brokers, they work with hedge funds and hedge fund like asset managers to help them do everything from figure out who to trade with and which trading platforms to implement to like how to make sure that they can pass an SEC audit when they come through to check on their practices and policies. So I would sit down with groups at prime brokers from Goldman to Morgan Stanley to UBS and everybody else and hedge fund managers. And I would say to them, hey, I just left Goldman. I'm building a software company. Our platform is going to touch your most sensitive client data and it's going to do it all on the internet. And they would just laugh. They'd say, you're a total idiot. There's no way anyone's going to do this, right? No one will ever trust the internet. And I was like, well, this is exactly why you're wrong, because we were at the peak sort of period just when everyone was unsure of the internet, unsure of the power therein, unsure of where the web was going to go. And within years, I mean, you'd be an idiot not to be building for the web.
Right. You and Mark Benioff from Salesforce having the last laugh. Good.
Well, he was my inspiration. So when he started that company in 99 and really got things going with Salesforce and the whole no software mode, I mean, like, our platform is a CRM as well. And so, you know, I would be totally lying if I said I never looked at Salesforce's playbook and didn't idolize the marketing machine that is Salesforce. And actually, that's another perfect example of it's not the best product. In fact, Salesforce has become exactly what it set out to destroy, in that it set out to destroy Siebel and SAP and these gigantic behemoth systems that are really hard to use.
Right.
It's not now, but the reason it won is because they are a marketing master. Like, that guy and that company is the most brilliant example of how to market a business that's probably next to Apple and like maybe the best.
That's
but
right.
What's funny and ironic, and to answer, to sort of give you a bit more color. So with Backstop, we started the world's first SaaS company for institutional asset managers to help them with marketing and investor relations and communications. Well, at the time that I co-founded Backstop, there was a company called Imagineer Technology Group that was founded by a good friend of mine named Errol Ducey. Today, my day job is I'm the CEO of Imagineer Technology Group. And so what's funny and ironic is I've sort of come full circle with my day job regarding the types of markets that I work in and the customers that we serve. But what was really interesting was that when Imagineer was first started, it was desktop software. It was what was called a client server model. It was like the Siebel model, right? You buy the software, you buy the hardware, you implement it, you run it in your office.
Right, and you have to shut down the system overnight to run it, to install an update once a quarter.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was, you know, in the beginning of the Backstop days, we competed against Clientier on the basis that, well, we're always available anywhere you are, blah, 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 blah. And there are pros to that and cons to that. Well, over time, obviously, Errol and the team at Imagineer, they're incredibly brilliant people and super smart guys and gals. And they said, well, yeah, we're going to get there. And so, of course, they did over time. And so the Imagineer platforms, which are called Clientier and WebVision, slowly but surely over the 2000s made their way up into the cloud as well, as it became clear that the cloud was going to win and that everything would be in the cloud. So it's kind of funny that, you know, things have gone full circle, where we ended up putting all the businesses that were client server focused solutions out of business along the way. And Imagineer, which was way back then was a distant second or third in the race, over time, because of its strengths and because of its dedication and, quite frankly, its technology stack, became the number two player in the market. And as fate would have it, now, what is it, 20 months ago or so, I had the opportunity to get back together with Errol and the team at Imagineer, and we merged a company that I'd started after doing the post-Backstop business to Imagineer. And now we've taken a lot of the technologies that we built with the last company, it's called Synapp for what it's worth, and we've been able to embed ourselves into and with the Imagineer teams, and now we're chugging along. We've got bigger markets, but it's fun. Yeah.
So Tell us about, so when you started Synapt,
yeah,
that was one of, I believe, three companies you started pretty much simultaneously?
Within a week of each other, yep.
Right. Yep. So what were they, and how the hell did you do that?
So there's a story here. There's a story. So
I can't imagine there isn't.
When I left the day-to-day of Backstop, my wife, who is my not just my soulmate, but is my rock and is my anchor and is the one person in my life that keeps me from frying myself out completely, looked at me in the eye and she said, "Make me one promise, and that is that you will not start a new company for at least 2 years." And this is the day I walked out of my last day at Backstop. I was like, "Okay, cool. I can do that. I can do that. I can make it a couple years without starting something else." And so, you know, 22 months in, my wife was like, "Hey, if you want to get started on something new, I can tell you're ready for it. You need it. Like, you're dying. You have my blessing." And I was like, "Great." And we started three companies within a week of each other. One was called Synapt. Another one was called Zoku Vault. And a third, we're actually, although we've been building the platform and building the business for the past, whatever it is now, 4 years and change, we're actually announcing the business publicly a couple of days from now. And sadly, the business and the brand is under embargo for the next couple of days. But it was exciting. So my wife, bless her soul, was like, "Yeah, go ahead, start another one." And we did.
The idea, the startup that's under embargo, you know, and only share what you're comfortable sharing. Yeah. Let's just say a little birdie told me it has nothing to do with finance and hedge funds and SaaS.
It does not. It has nothing at all to do with the financial markets, with financial services, or with, I mean, there's technology associated with it, but it's not a software company. So, it's actually in the hospitality and health and wellness space of all things, and it's a pretty fun endeavor. I can't wait to tell you all about it. It's gonna be really neat. Actually, I will say this: I moved to my current home in my current town here in the suburbs of Chicago to build this business. So I'm really excited about it. It's gonna be a lot of fun.
And how do you divide your time and energy and bandwidth between three businesses?
Yeah, so you can't be all things to all people at the end of the day, right? So it was essential that when we started the companies, we were very clear, and I say myself, my wife, and my co-founders in each of the different businesses, were all very clear from day one, like what the priorities would be and, you know, where I would focus my time. So at the time, I became the chairman and CEO of Synapt Software Labs. That's the company that we ultimately merged into Imagineer. And so that has had my focus, the vast majority of my focus since starting that software business back in 2015. And post the merger with Imagineer, that is my day job, I like to call it. So, you know, my 50 to 7,000 hour a week job is Imagineer / what we did with Synapt. The other platforms, with one of them is also a software company, a financial services software company, and it needed a CEO because there's no way I could do it. As it happens, a good friend of mine who's a former client was super interested in starting a technology company, and we were having tacos one day, just catching up on stuff, and he's like, "Oh, I want to go start a software company that does this." And I was like, "That's funny, because I have here on my phone, I can show you my like working demo of that exact thing. And here's like 7 years of research I've done. And here's all the, we're ready to go. We'll write a check and we'll get some funding in place. Let's go do it." So it was serendipitous timing. But I would not have been able to start that one had my friend, someone who I trusted and who was ready to be a CEO, step up and say, "I want to go do that." And so he left his job as the CFO of a hedge fund to go do that.
So the point is, you sort of have to know your limitations, know you can't do it all, and then find people you trust to take the reins. So you have to be able to let go of some stuff in order for everything to work.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're 100% right. And that's the same thing we did with the other one. We hired a full-time staff to work on parts of the project for us. And you know, I'm obviously very, very, very heavily involved, but not in the weeds. You can't be in the weeds at all. Thing you got to pick one thing to be in the weeds of at a time.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, and speaking of how you fit it all in, how do you have any tips? Because I think this is something I feel like so many of my listeners and executive coaching clients struggle with is having the discipline to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Primarily sure. with exercise. And, yep. and that's just people who, you know, want to get a little cardio in here and there and maybe lift some weights. And you're on the other end of the spectrum where you're training to run, you know, 30 to 80 miles in a marathon. So what are some best practices for making sure that you do that stuff? Like yeah. what works for you?
Yeah. So, and I guess I would say with the caveat that what works for me can't work for everybody just because of who I am, right?
My own personality. Of course, yeah.
There's a lot to be said about that. Again, like I honestly think being a DI is the only thing that enables me to do it because I'm a planner and a crazy driven person. And so I guess the one word I would use to describe how I make it work is planning. So everything is scheduled. Like literally every moment of my day is scheduled, either in writing or mentally. And I do that. And I mean, I even schedule like my downtime. And today I'm going to watch, you know, season 2, episode 1 of Mindhunter. Like that's my downtime. And I'm watching it on the train ride home. And then for 20 minutes while my kids are doing homework, that's how I'm going to finish that show. But it's on my list of crap to do today. And it's as important to me as the conference call I have after this, because it's one of my release points. Right. For me, the type of person I am, like, I've always been an athlete. I've always been very active, except for one sort of 3-year period where I wasn't. And during that one sort of 3-year period where I wasn't, like, I fell apart. And so for me, again, the sports angle, the ultra marathon angle, it's all part of a bigger sort of plan. And so for me, like if I'm out there running 20 miles, let's say, or biking 75 miles or doing, you know, an adventure race for a day, like that time that I'm out there is the perfect time to do what I like to call temptation bundling. So I fill up that time with other activities as well as the running and the thing. When I'm training, it's all about, okay, physical reaction and what are my legs doing and what are my muscles telling me and how am I going to get through this and or how am I going to improve my shape, my coordination, whatever it might be. But when you're doing a 10-hour race, like you're not worried, you're worrying about form because you get injured if you don't, but like you've got a lot of time to think. Right. And so for me, it's a way to kill two birds with one stone.
Interesting.
It really is. Okay. And so for me, being outside, being in the outdoors, doing endurance athletics and things, it's pure catharsis. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you said something really important, which is it's as important to me as the conference call or fill in the blank. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of people fall down.
Oh yeah, you gotta be so selfish with your time.
Like I'm less, you know, because essentially what you're saying when you say I don't have time to go to the gym or to yoga or whatever is I'm not a priority to myself.
Right.
Like I'm
exactly.
putting everyone and everything else ahead of my own health and wellness needs.
Right.
And I think when you start to look at it that way, it doesn't feel good, and it's certainly not the way ambitious people want to have, you know, their own self-image shaping up into, and so it's, I guess it's that shift in belief that it is as important as everything else that finally gets people to prioritize it into the calendar and stick to it.
Absolutely. There's also ways to bundle it with other things you need to do anyway, case in point, or want to do anyway, like the business that we're announcing later on this week. I started with one of my best friends in the whole wide world, and he and I do adventure races and ultra marathons together. And we hashed out parts of this business model and parts of this vision while running through the mountains of Moab, Utah, right? And while we were dying in the mountains we were doing an adventure race, you know, canoeing down the Mississippi River. Like you can find ways to combine the things you love with the things that you have to do, right? And there's a lot of things we have. I've been very fortunate. I mentioned my wife earlier, who is my favorite human being on the planet. And every day I'm so grateful that she chose to be with me and that she chooses to stick with me, because I can be a tough guy to be with, because I'm pretty driven to do stuff, right? And that can be pretty challenging sometimes. But I've also got 4 amazing kids who are just remarkable people, despite my inadequacies and ridiculousness. I've got a sophomore in college, a sophomore in high school, a freshman in high school, and a third grader. And, you know, you can find ways, I try to find ways to engage with them in activities that selfishly I enjoy and that I know they enjoy too. Whether it's music or playing a card game or, you know, playing a video game with them, whatever it is, like you can find ways, you have to find ways to sort of plug in multiple likes and multiple desires into, and sort of fit them into situations. Otherwise you can't balance it all. And
right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, so Leader Shifters, if you are one of those folks who struggles to prioritize the activities, whether it's working out or time with the kids or whatever it is, I think that's the question to walk away from this podcast episode asking yourself is, what are some ways that I can combine the things that I enjoy, the things I'm passionate about, with the things that I'm doing anyway, right? So that makes it easier and you're killing two birds with one stone, as Jeremy said. Oh, wow. So I feel like I have a million more questions for you. I think I'm just going to ask you one more and then wrap it up, because otherwise we might have the longest podcast episode ever.
Sorry.
and this is so key. What do you look for when you're hiring someone? Like, because a lot of people have what looks good on paper. So what special sauce do you look for in someone so that you know that they're going to honor and respect the culture? And are there any particular questions you use to assess that?
Sure. So it varies a little bit by job function, for sure. Sure. But the one or two universal things I'm always looking for in teammates are, number one is ability to focus. And I think ability to focus is different from focused. And we don't have time to go into the reasons for that, but ability to focus is super high on my list of wants in any candidate for any role. Compassion and empathy also are top of list for me. Open-mindedness and transparency, just a natural disposition to be, to have a broad and open and accepting worldview, is essential to me. I guess the other two things I look for in every candidate, one is a sense of gratitude. We could unpack that a thousand different ways, but I'll just leave it at a single word, gratitude.
Yeah.
Because there's a million angles you can go there, but in general, like that's the people, I love being around people who are grateful for what they have. And the last thing is a service orientation. So the desire to help other people and serve other people, not to be subservient to people, but to serve others, and to help other people get what it is they need and or want and or like and want to achieve and want to be. I think that you combine those qualities, and experience doesn't really matter. Educational pedigree, except in certain situations and for certain types of jobs, doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You give me someone who's a go-getter and a hustler and who's, you know, empathetic and passionate and shows gratitude and a desire to serve, and like that's a guy or a girl I want to work with for sure.
Absolutely. Good. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm just going to do a quick wrap up and tick through some of the highlights that I just jotted down as we were talking with, you know, entrepreneur since he was 8 years old with consolidating paper routes to, you know, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. You're on your fifth startup, I think, if I counted right.
There's a couple others, but yeah, well, that's good enough.
Okay. You're going to have a baker's dozen soon. I think one of the important lessons about going to work at Goldman, even though you knew you were meant for entrepreneurship, is to be a little patient and get the experience and the learning you need. Like, it doesn't have to happen now. In fact, like, what the fact that you had the foresight to do that demonstrates, like, ready, aim, fire. And a lot of entrepreneurs are just like, I have a great idea, I'm going to go, right? And I get that sometimes timing is of the essence, and if you don't do it, someone else is going to steal your idea. But I think, you know, sort of balance that against, you need some experience, like, because you might have a great idea, but you might be completely inept at building and running a company. Mm-hmm. So I love that you did that, and I think that's a really great lesson for Leader Shifters. Of course, the fact that culture comes first is always music to my ears. And the great lesson in the best leaders are students of human behavior, psychology, psychometrics, right? Because we're all a little bit different. And there's a lot to be learned from that. And to me, the best teams have a variety of people, the whole spectrum, because, you know, when we talk about hiring people that are a good fit, mm-hmm. what that usually means is I'm going to hire people just like me or just like us. Well, then you end up getting a whole bunch of people who think the same way, as yeah. opposed to let's hire people who come from all different perspectives. And that's what's going to give us the richness to succeed and differentiate ourselves. Let's see. I love the part about recognizing that we can't do it all, right? There's only so much time in the day, and no matter how many zeros we have in the bank account, we can't manufacture more or buy more time in the day. So it's like, okay, know what your limitations are, find people you trust to help you, and let them go, right? Like, trust them enough to let go of the reins and let them do their thing, and then you're creating bigger pie. Because otherwise, if you're trying to split your effort among too many things, everything's mediocre.
Exactly.
And then, you know, I would say the last couple of things in terms of prioritize yourself, and whether it is about your health and wellness and your workouts or something else that you're not making the time to do. Maybe you're not making the time to read books for pleasure. Maybe you're not taking the time to take your dog on a long walk, or, you know, whatever it is. Make it as important as the investor meeting. Make it as important as, you know, meeting deadlines for clients, right? It's got to be that important, or else you'll never do it. And then I love your list of things that you look for in candidates. And so I'm just going to read them back off, because, folks, whether you're an entrepreneur or a leader in a bigger organization, hiring the right people, that's what makes it. It's what makes it tick. So, ability to focus, compassion and empathy, open-mindedness, transparent, gratitude, and service-oriented. All right. So, my gratitude, Jeremy, for having you on the leadership show today. It was a pleasure to catch up with you and give you an opportunity to tell your super interesting story to the audience of Leadershifters.
Well, thanks very much again for having me on the show, Shani. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. So if people are interested in any of your products or have follow-up questions, like, what's the best way to get in touch with you or just, like, learn more about you?
Yeah, sure. I think the very best way to get in touch with me is through LinkedIn. You can also find me at jeremybacon.com and get in touch with me that way too. But it'll all take you to the same place. You'll probably find your way to LinkedIn at the end.
And it's Jeremy, not with a Y, but with an I-E, everyone.
Right. Yeah, J-E-R-E-M-I-E B-A-C-O-N.
Bacon, like the yummy pork.
Like the delicious food product, yeah.
All right, Leadershifters, and you know how to reach me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, et cetera, et cetera. Until next time, thanks for watching and listening.
Mwah. Thanks so much.